This is The Guardian.
Today, it's budget day in the UK, but just who is the man who'll deliver it? Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak, the UK Chancellor, has a pretty carefully honed public image. It's very shiny, suspiciously free of blemishes, and ultimately, a little bland. So it's no wonder he feels so at home on Instagram.
I thought it would be a great time to take stock and let you know what my priorities are for this year.
He's smart, looks good in a suit, made millions of pounds, and on top of all that, married into one of India's richest families. Barely into his 40s, Rishi Sunak is already one of the most powerful people in the UK.
Get our vaccine done. Number two priority, budget.
Last year, he was suddenly launched into number 11, just as the country entered its worst crisis in decades. He responded by launching the largest economic help scheme the UK had ever seen.
I'd say just thank you for everything you've done.
Oh, and that's very
for
kind.
For businesses and to help the team.
It's so great to see the place springing back to life.
And then, this year, made the biggest overnight cut in welfare ever enacted. So, what does the man in charge of the British economy really believe? With today's autumn budget, and the government trying to look beyond the pandemic for the first time, we just might get our best clue yet. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, who is the real Rishi Sunak? Heather Stewart, you're The Guardian's political editor, and without knowing a great deal about Rishi Sunak, he seems to have lived one of these charmed lives where nothing ever seems to go wrong, he seems to impress in whatever environment he's in, and he's always rising. How far back does that effect seem to go?
Well, I think probably right back to his childhood.
I wasn't massively into politics when I was that young. The inspiration for me was my parents, mum
and
dad.
His grandparents were Punjabi Indians who emigrated from Uganda in East Africa. And his parents, you know, were obviously hardworking and rose themselves. So his father was a GP. He had a practice in Southampton. His mother ran a local pharmacy.
And so I worked for my mum in the shop and delivered prescriptions out and helped her. And it was through that that I got a sense of the difference they'd made to our community.
And I guess a sort of pivot point for Rishi came when they decided to send him to Winchester School, which is one of our most sort of prestigious public schools. I think that was probably the point at which his trajectory changed and he was en route for something pretty special.
And so he gets to this very fancy public school and he doesn't just sit there. He kind of stands out. He excels. What does he do after he graduates?
It's a sort of classic path, right? He does well at school. He's quite good at sports, say, people who were there with him. He's also quite good at his schoolwork. He ends up being sort of head boy, makes it all sound terribly easy, which is a sort of characteristic of him. And then off he goes to Oxford University, of course, studies politics, philosophy and economics, of course, gets a first, of course. You know, it's sort of almost too smooth, or it's kind of the classic biography for, you know, a conservative politician. And while some of his contemporaries at Oxford would have been, you know, propping up the bar or joining the beer society or getting into politics, he decided the route to go down was to join the investment society, where they would have bankers come from the city and talk to them. So he'd obviously decided at quite a young age, even as a teenager, that I guess that making money was important to him, more important than perhaps than having fun.
I bet they had great parties, the investment society.
They sound like crazy guys, don't they? Yeah. He was obviously, I guess, sort of studious and serious and looking at the road ahead, even as a teenager.
And he goes into business and wouldn't you know it, he's a huge success there too. What does he do?
So he goes to Goldman Sachs, which of course is one of the American city banks. He's there for a few years and he then went off into the sort of very fashionable world of hedge funds, eventually ended up setting up or being involved in the founding of his own investment firm, his own hedge fund, which was a sort of interesting, sexy bit of finance to be in, I suppose, at that time, not to mention incredibly well remunerated.
Incredibly well. I mean, he made millions, but that isn't his only source of wealth, is it?
No, it isn't. He also seems to have done incredibly well even in choosing his partner.
N.R. Narayan Murthy ko kaun nahi janta, lekin unke saath saji dhaji.
He studied at Stanford for a bit in the US, and there he met Akshatamurthy, whose father was the founder of the Indian technology giant Infosys and one of India's wealthiest men.
Your father-in-law is obviously Narayan Murthy. Everyone, he's a household name in India.
He's quite shrewdly managed to marry into money as well as making quite a lot of it himself.
I mean, I'm very fortunate, you know, to have someone like him as, you know, as family.
He's done quite well for himself on all fronts, really.
Rishi Sunak.
Yeah! Madam Deputy Speaker, thank you for allowing me to make my first contribution to this House.
So at this point in his life, he's so rich that he doesn't even need to work anymore, let alone take on one of the most incredibly demanding jobs that there is. Why does he decide to get into politics, and how does he actually make that happen?
It's almost part of this sort of same charmed life. You know, he makes some good Tory friends and he ends up being able to stand for this incredibly safe seat of Richmond in Yorkshire, which was William Hague's seat. He's kind of gone where he could with the high finance. He'd made his money and, you know, off he goes into politics. And I think his argument would be, you know, there was a sort of sense of public service.
Yeah, and straight away he's pitched into that Europe question. You know, it's the biggest, most divisive question in modern Tory history. And if you're a Labour MP, I guess it's a bit more obvious which way you go on Brexit. But if you're a Conservative, you've got to choose whether you back the Eurosceptics or your Prime Minister at the time. And I imagine that's a pretty hard call for a young, ambitious MP. What did Rishi do?
Big call for him as well, because he sort of came into Parliament under the wing of David Cameron. You know, David Cameron had a thing of sort of fast-tracking what he thought were promising sort of clever young candidates. So David Cameron was kind of a bit of a mentor, even a friend. And there was a real loyalty test at that point, because Cameron really wanted all of his kind of supporters to fall in behind him and, of course, back the Remain campaign.
We are approaching one of the biggest decisions this country will face in our lifetimes. Whether to remain in a reformed European Union or to leave.
Rishi Sunak doesn't make his decision until after two other key players, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, have made theirs. He did have some sort of Eurosceptic tendencies even way back in 97. I suspect it will also have played into it that he will have felt his constituency was quite likely to vote leave. It did in the end. All of those factors will have contributed, I think, to the fact that he decided to go for vote leave.
All right, that was a huge decision, and obviously he picked the winning side. Then you had all of the trauma of the Theresa May years, and after that, Rishi Sunak reaches the second big moment, which is who to back as her successor, and he chooses Boris Johnson. Now, in retrospect, that might seem like a really natural move for him to have made at the time, but how did that actually play out?
Sunak came out quite early for Johnson. If you're a politician, it's always good to pick the winning side, because then, you know, you might do quite nicely out of it. I'm sure he thought Boris Johnson could win a general election, but he may well also have thought, I'm going to hitch my wagon to this guy and he'll help me to move on in my career. And when Boris Johnson formed his cabinet, there was Rishi Sunak on the front bench. He got the prime job of Chief Secretary of the Treasury. It's really quite a prominent role for someone who'd only come into Parliament in 2015.
Heather, for everything you're saying, I mean, I understand that Rishi Sunak could have been a kind of golden boy at school and then college and in the banking world, but he entered UK politics at a pretty polarised time, and yet he's shown this ability to make difficult calls, get them right, and seemingly do all that without having his reputation tainted, both in public and in the party. That's pretty remarkable.
Part of it, I think, is his personality. So almost everyone you talk to, if you talk to civil servants who work with him, if you talk to sort of fellow MPs, he's evidently quite a well-liked guy. You know, he doesn't seem to be abrasive. He doesn't seem to have the characteristics of sort of bullying, or a lot of MPs have colossal egos. And that doesn't seem to be in his personality as far as anyone can tell. You know, he's sort of, you know, goes around being Mr. Nice Guy.
Three Indian origin legislators now form the top three of Boris Johnson's cabinet. Let's start with the man who is now number two in Westminster, Rishi Sunak.
So Sunak becomes Chancellor very suddenly last year. He's gone from rising star to suddenly the second biggest job in government. How does that come about?
It was a bit of a mess.
Chancellor Sajid Javid has resigned. Now that is a pretty shock piece of news, certainly.
At the time, Boris Johnson's very sort of pugnacious advisor, Dominic Cummings, was still running the show in number 10. He felt that Sajid Javid, who was the Chancellor, wasn't sufficiently on message. So they sort of stitched up a plan where they would say to Javid, actually, instead of having your own economic advisors that you've chosen, you're now going to have to share them with Number 10. So you and Johnson will have a sort of joint team of advisors. Well, Javid felt, you know, my pride doesn't allow me to do that. So he resigned.
In the last few minutes, I've heard that the Chancellor, Sajid Javid, has decided that rather than obey the orders of the Prime Minister to sack his advisory team, he has instead turned down the second most important job.
Sunak, who is seen as super loyal and sort of super effective by Johnson's team, he gets brought in. You know, he's very young, he's not even 40. He's known as a sort of close ally of the Johnson team, and the feeling was that he'd been brought in as a kind of puppet.
Therefore, we have a big elevation for Rishi Sunak, who was considered in conservative circles as somebody who was a rising star, but for someone with a relatively little level of experience, a huge elevation for him.
We've said so far that Rishi Sunak has lived a charmed life, and the way he became Chancellor certainly plays into that, but it's a few weeks into the job where that luck appears to run out pretty dramatically, or so it seems, when the coronavirus goes from being a distant problem to suddenly the greatest economic threat the UK's faced in decades, perhaps longer. How does Rishi Sunak deal with that?
While Number 10 really were more thinking about, you know, what do we do about the sort of public health side of things, the Treasury's job was to swing into action and try and devise lots of support schemes, in fact, business support schemes and so on, but also something to deal with the fact that lots of people were about to be sort of thrown on the scrap heap because their businesses had had to close. Sunak kind of gets his head down, looks at the numbers and devises this really incredibly radical furlough scheme.
Today, I am making available an initial £330 billion of guarantees, equivalent to 15% of our GDP.
I was sitting in the room in Downing Street when he announced it. I was an economics journalist for a long time, so I've covered, you know, covered the financial crisis, covered the Greek bailout, all those things. But I never thought I'd be sitting in a room with the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying the taxpayer was going to pay the wages of literally millions of people. And, you know, here he was, this really quite new Chancellor who'd only been in the job a few weeks, having to devise and announce this. It was a pretty extraordinary moment.
I said whatever it takes, and I meant it.
That announcement too must have been the moment when most people got their first good look at this guy. And it's not a bad look. I mean, it's this moment of crisis and here's Rishi Sunak coming to shore up your business, pay your wages, get you through this.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's hard to dislike the guy who's who's saying, you know, I'm going to prevent you from losing your job. You know, this was a time of sort of largesse from the Treasury and he had this language about, you know, doing whatever it takes to protect people's jobs and livelihoods and so on. And of course, also he was a real contrast with Johnson, whose communications have been erratic, to say the least.
It's a meal deal like never before.
And then a few months later, after the first coronavirus wave passed, Sunak spearheaded another really popular government program, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which saw his face literally plastered on the front of restaurants around the country. People were toasting his name as they ate half-price dinners.
Yes, you are right. Eat Out to Help Out. It was, at the time, incredibly popular.
I think the scheme is really good. I'm using it twice today.
I've certainly been out much more sort of Monday to Wednesday since they've had the scheme.
It was also questioned, even at the time, about whether it was really a good idea to be encouraging people back into town centres and encouraging people back to their desks. You know, he got himself photographed in Wagamama on the day it was announced, delivering lunches to people. He's not wearing a mask. He consciously launched it partly because he thought people were too frightened of getting back out and about and again. You know, we'd all been told to stay in our homes for months. It was also incredibly expensive, of course, and some of that money was spent on subsidising the dinners of people who could very much afford to, you know, pay for their own dinner. So I think there were lots of questions, even when it was first announced, about whether it was a great plan.
The UK's main tax official raised questions about whether this is good use of what could be £500 million, with taxpayers footing the bill, showing once again there's no such thing as a free lunch.
But yes, there he is with his face all over cheap dinners out for British families.
One of the drawbacks of that plan, Heather, too, was the fact that, at least according to one study, it may have been a mistake in the sense that it was linked to something between 8 and 17% of COVID clusters that emerged in August and September from people mixing indoors again. And yet, in what feels like a bit of a pattern here, none of that seemed to really leave a scuff on Sunak's reputation.
No, I think that's right. And I think that's partly because it got sort of subsumed under a much wider argument about whether the government did the right thing last summer and into last autumn. At the time when the questions were being asked about Eat Out to Help Out and whether it had really been the right approach, looking back, it does seem pretty extraordinary that the government was literally paying people, as it were, to get out and, you know, huddle together in restaurants over that period when we subsequently had an incredibly damaging second and then a third wave.
Let's talk about that broader argument about how to actually handle the pandemic. Eat Out to Help Out gives us a clue as to where Sunak's instincts may have been and all that. You know, he apparently was for the economy. Is that fair to say? And where has he been on that question in the time since?
It's a slight caricature, but not a complete caricature, to say that he was often pressing for things to be reopened. And it would be Matt Hancock who, of course, was seeing all the data from the health service and thinking about it more from a public health point of view. So next sort of advisors would say, well, yeah, that's because he's the economy guy. And that's his role in that conversation, is to say, you know, look at how many jobs will be under threat and so on. But I think also people would say that's probably his instinct. He's more of a kind of small state conservative. He's one of those who instinctively didn't particularly like the idea that the government was intervening so drastically in people's lives. He was sort of keen to lift things as soon as possible. And though he was the guy who was announcing, we'll do whatever it takes, he was also very keen to sort of turn off the financial taps as soon as he could.
Heather, this is a really momentous time for Britain's economy, and it's being overseen by someone who seemingly came from nowhere, and a person who, in the teeth of a crisis, acted against what you say his real instincts were. I mean, no conservative goes into politics so they can pay the wages of nearly the entire British workforce. What do we know about Rishi Sunak's brand of conservative politics? Like, some have called him a Thatcherite at heart, but where do you think the truth lies?
So it's slightly hard to know, because he's not someone who goes around making big speeches about his philosophy. And also, he's not someone who had a long period on the back benches where you can sort of look back and analyse it and say, right, OK, this is where he stood on this great argument of the day. And of course, once you're in government, you know, there's collective responsibility and you have to sort of stick with the party line. But he certainly has, at various points, struck a slightly different tone, I would say, to the Prime Minister.
A big part of Rishi Sunak's attempt to connect with the public is through Instagram, which we've all done a lot of looking through over the last few days. And I'm struck by how glossy it all is. Like, everything is so aspirational and polished.
It was a saviour to jobs.
I didn't know of anything like this had ever taken place.
It's been a privilege to work on the scheme. I'll never forget it.
There's a video that tells the story of the furlough policy with, like, heroic music and slow motion shots of bureaucrats walking around the office. Very exciting.
Someone said, we need a better name. No one knows what furlough is. And I remember in the meeting saying, oh, they will.
What does it tell you that he so deliberately tried to craft that kind of image?
Well, I think that's a potential route to the leadership, right? So there are different ways to become Prime Minister. One of them is to sort of really spend a lot of time cultivating backbenchers and hope that they will sort of catapult you into the race. The other is to make it completely clear that you're the guy the public would like, you know, that people sort of like the look of you. And actually, polling tells you that the public like the look of Rishi Sunak a lot more than they like the look of Boris Johnson these days.
We said we would stand together with the British people, and we meant it.
He definitely spends a lot of sort of time and thought on this image stuff. He talks about how much he enjoys his sort of time on the Peloton exercise bike in the morning. And, you know, he's quite keen to talk about his sort of lifestyle. I mean, we should remember this is an absolutely multi-millionaire lifestyle, right? I mean, he has this extremely large property in his Richmond constituency, a couple of properties in London, I think, and one on the West Coast in the States. He put a planning application in the summer to build a sort of block next to his mansion in Yorkshire, which will have a swimming pool and a gym in it. That's part of the reason for the gloss, I think. This is an incredibly rich guy.
So we know that one of the reasons Rishi was trusted to be Chancellor was that he was perceived to be loyal to Boris Johnson, someone who wouldn't make a fuss in the way that Sajid Javid had. That's why he got the job. 18 months in, how does that relationship between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak look?
Personally, they still get on pretty well, or so I'm told. You know, I think they're sort of friends. However, they do seem to have been on slightly different political trajectories a bit of late. And I think it's been possible to see a bit of strain between the two. Boris Johnson tends to be quite sort of spendthrift. He's also the sort of prime minister who looks a lot at the headlines and wants immediate short-term political problems to be resolved, and often in a way that involves spending money. So we had an example recently where businesses are saying they're really being hit hard by rocketing energy prices. The Chancellor's instinct is, well, you know, this is something businesses are probably going to have to sort out themselves. It's probably a long-term problem. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, coming out and saying, oh, actually, you know, we're going to need to help these guys, and clashing with the Treasury quite publicly over that. Well, most people at Westminster see that as a bit of a proxy war, and that really it's the Prime Minister who is wanting to solve this problem of days and days of headlines.
Okay. Are you concerned about the relationship between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer? It feels to be tense.
This summer, there was a letter that was leaked which suggested that Sunak would like to see some of the travel restrictions lifted to allow people to sort of get back to normal life, normal holidays, at a time when Downing Street was being quite cautious about some of those things. It read a little bit like one of those letters that had been written in order to be leaked. That apparently caused some consternation. Johnson was quite cross about that, reportedly even sort of joked to colleagues or suggested to colleagues maybe it's time to move Sunak.
This isn't one of those times. I think the Prime Minister and the Chancellor work very effectively together. I think they're a great team.
And of course, very recently in the government strategy for net zero, where again, we had the Treasury publishing a document that sort of stressed the risks and the costs of this big transition we're going to have to make and how much of a dent it was going to make in tax revenues and so on. And on the same day, you had lots of other government documents really sort of stressing the benefits of it, and Boris Johnson talking about, you know, how brilliant technology was going to kind of get us through and it was all going to be very easy. It does show you that certainly Sunak thinks it's in his interest to assert himself a little bit, and also that he's just has slightly different instincts and perhaps just isn't willing to just be along for the ride.
Heather, with the worst of the pandemic hopefully behind us, we're entering a new phase for the British economy where a lot of that money that was spent has to be paid back. And we're starting to see the beginnings of that. Sunak has announced a rise in national insurance, a cut in universal credit. We've talked about how he's had this ability to make a lot of difficult calls without his reputation suffering too badly. Is it fair to say that what lies ahead is going to be the biggest test of that Teflon quality that he has?
Yeah, I think it really is. If you look at the polling about his sort of public perceptions of Sunak in recent weeks and months, it started to dip a bit. You know, his name is all over a series of cuts and tax rises that are being made. So there's that national insurance increase.
From next April, we will ask businesses, employees and the self-employed to pay an extra 1.25% on earnings.
There's the £1,000 a year for poor families, the universal credit cut. The think tanks, the Resolution Foundation, for example, say it's the biggest overnight benefit cut in history.
The thing we would really have to wrestle with, whether we can feed our children, whether we can clothe our children.
But it's quite hard to be that incredibly popular guy when not only are you no longer paying people's wages, but you're taking money away from people, I think.
So it sounds like Rishi Sunak has ahead of him decisions that whichever way he goes, he's going to leave some people unhappy. It might not be so easy to just sail through it the way he seems to have done with everything else. In the context of that bigger struggle, how important is today's budget?
I think it's very important because I think it sort of sets the agenda. Alongside the budget, it's a three-year spending review, so it will tell us how he's allocating resources among the different government departments over the next 3 years. We'll also get a sense of whether he's really willing to put the public resources necessary behind this sort of charge towards net zero. And I think also we might get some short-term emergency measures to cope with this sort of worrying winter that we have ahead of rising prices and so on. So I think it'll be quite important because it'll be Sunak in a different phase, really. Although we've obviously got a tricky few months ahead with the pandemic, it does feel as if he's going to be looking beyond that and maybe give us a sense of the sort of Britain that he has in mind when he's drawing up those spending plans.
Coming up, The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, on what to expect from today's budget. Larry Elliott, you're The Guardian's economics editor, and the Chancellor isn't supposed to talk about the budget before it's announced in the Commons today, but even more than usual, his office has been giving previews to friendly newspapers, and Sunak himself has done a few interviews. What have we learned from that blitz about what we can expect today?
A lot of the announcements have been about capital projects, spending money on things like extra equipment and capital for the NHS to get rid of the backlog of waiting times. There's been some money for transport infrastructure. That's all very much part of the levelling up story, which is supposed to be aimed at the less well-off parts of Britain to upgrade their transport networks. But there've been other things. There's money been showered on the arts. There's been money for the national living wage is going to go up. Public sector pay is going to go up. So it's very much the sort of message that the economy has recovered from the pandemic. The government is on the side of ordinary people and is going to have their back, which is the Chancellor's favourite phrase, will have their back as the economy emerges from the crisis.
One of the striking things about these announcements we've seen so far is that there doesn't appear to be an appetite to return to the kinds of austerity politics that we saw the Tories put in place after the 2008-2009 financial crisis. How long can we expect this more lavish version of Rishi Sunak to win out?
Well, I think we'd have to look quite carefully at the budget small print to see whether that's true. Yes, they're going to be some increases in spending, some increases in infrastructure spending, but day-to-day spending by government departments is going to have to be squeezed quite hard, I think, because the other side of the coin is that the Chancellor wants to get the public finances back into some sort of shape so that he can deliver tax cuts for the next election, which could be as soon as the summer of 2023. And that means that some government departments, some of the less glamorous departments, Justice, Home Office, local government, are going to find it quite tough, I think. And what the government doesn't want is people saying this is a return to the austerity we saw at the start of the 2010 decade. But there will be some cuts for many parts of the Whitehall machine.
This must be a real tension at the heart of the party. On the one hand, they have their impulse to try to get the country's fiscal house in order. On the other hand, the country's not in a state where they can really be cutting from the budget. I mean, spending is required to get it back into a kind of post-pandemic shape.
Yeah, I mean, there are two parts of the Tory party's electoral coalition. The traditional half lives in the south of England and tends to be quite well off. And those people are not particularly bothered about increases in government spending on transport in the north. The increases in infrastructure spending, on other aspects of government spending, are aimed at the second half of the Conservative Party electoral coalition. The so-called red wall seats of the north of England and the Midlands, the government won in the 2019 election. And there, the reason that there's going to be higher spending for them now is that it takes time for any public spending increases to actually have an impact. So by the time of the next election, the government wants to be able to say, we spent the money, it's having an impact, you can feel the effect, vote for us again. For the other half of the Tory party coalition, the better off voters in the south, the aim there is to build up a war chest of money so that the government can deliver tax cuts for them as the next election approaches. So it's very much a twin-tracked approach. So it's spend now for people in the north and the Midlands, tax cuts later for people who live in the south.
Mm. We've been trying to get to the heart of who is the real Rishi Sunak. And I wonder, coming out of the process leading to this budget, the push and pull between the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, do you have a better sense now of what Rishi Sunak really believes, what his impulses are?
Well, he's got a picture of Nigel Lawson on the wall of his office, sort of big tax reforming Chancellor in Margaret Thatcher's administration in the 1980s. So you'd imagine that he was fairly dry in terms of his economic stance. And I think he is, by instinct, a small state, tax cutting, deregulation minded Chancellor. I think he's ended up as a high spending, high tax Chancellor just as by force of circumstance, not because that is his natural instinct. He has arrived at where he is almost by accident, but perhaps in today's budget we will see more of the authentic Sunak stand up.
Larry Elliott, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Larry Elliott, The Guardian's economics editor. Thank you to him and to The Guardian's political editor, Heather Stewart. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent and Elizabeth Casson. Sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We're back Thursday.